session number 10477, real one.
Mr. Rye. Mr. Rice, real one. Could you tell me, Mr. Rice, when it was that you joined the Navy and why?
Joined in 1932, and it was in the days of the Depression. I'd started off an apprenticeship as in an aircraft factory. The factory went bust, and I'd always want to join the Navy, and I think that was the deciding factor.
Was it easy to get in?
I think so. I went along the recruiting office, and I knew later on, I was next Chief Petty Officer Reiter, and he gave me some tests to do, a mathematical thing, which I did very well, and then he actually got a dictation from the Daily Telegraph, and I was never very good at spelling, so his spelling wasn't very good, but as I was sort of 100% on maths, he said, oh, I think that makes up for it, and then I had to go home and get permission from my parents, because I was only 16. You had to get permission to join if you were under 18, I think it was. My mother was reluctant, but my father said, well, that's it. As I say, and that 1932, things were fairly hard outside to get a job. And so he said, OK, then in I went, and from there I joined HMS Ganges at Shotley.
What was your training like there?
Tough.
In what way?
You used to get up at, I think, 5:30 in the morning. You had a cup of hot cocoa and a biscuit. And I remember we used to have to wash down the cupboard way with cold water from fire hoses and bare feet. I don't think it did us any harm.
Do you think it was unnecessarily harsh?
Not for a sailor, no. I think, I don't know what the other seven... No, I don't think it was too harsh. I think all the people that I've known that have been there at the time said it was damn tough. But afterwards, no, I think it was excellent training.
What branch of work did you take up in the Navy?
Oh, actually... I left Ganges in, I think it was January 34, joined the cruiser York, and we went to the American West India Station. And we were there for 2.5 years, and I decided to become a torpedoman. In those days, the torpedoman did all the electrics of the ship as well, and I was a sort of acting seaman torpedoman on board the cruiser. And then we came back in... if I look at this, it'll tell me back to Chatham in 1936. And then I went down to HMS Vernon, which was down at Portsmouth, and qualified for a leading torpedoman.
How did you come to be in the Fleet Arrow?
Right, after that, I joined HMS Brilliant, which was a destroyer in the 4th Destroyer Flotilla. We were then out to the Mediterranean, and the Spanish War was on then. We were getting bombed by, we weren't quite sure if it was Germans or Italians. And an Admiralty Fleet order came out asking for volunteers for the raiding pilot in the Fleet Air Arm. I then volunteered, and the requirement was that you had to be leading rate or passed a certain educational qualification and recommended by your captain. I put in my request, and the captain said, okay, if you want to do that. I can't remember the captain's name, he was Lieutenant Commander at the time. Then we came back to home to Chatham. An interview ward was arranged on board HMS Courageous. We came down to Portsmouth, and I was lucky to be selected for the course. We then had to go to Astral House, the RAF, because the Navy didn't have any testing for aircrew at that time. We then passed the medical, and 20 of us went up to RAF Lucas in Scotland and commenced our flying training. There was 16 of us qualified and got our wings. I then went to the Courageous to do deck landings, and actually I was rather lucky. I was the first rating pilot to land on an aircraft carrier. Just a coincidence, I happened to be the first one.
How did you take to deck landings?
Looking back now, I say no problem. But no, I don't think. We were using Swordfish in those days, and we did, I think it was, you had to do 30 landings, and that was it. But you went on board the ship in Rosyth by boat, and actually you flew off, then did your landings, and I think we did 6 at a time, and then waited, and pilots in our deck landing course, they were all ex-RAF officers who turned over to the Fleet Air Arm. There was only another rating, Ernie Waterhouse and myself, who were the leading seaman at the time. Obviously passed the deck landing course, was then sent down to here, to Leon Solent, to do a seaplane conversion course. Did a seaplane conversion course, and it lasted about 6 weeks. And then I went to Portland to join 771 Squadron, which was Swordfish on floats, which was a fleet requirements unit. We used to do target towing, spotting and all that sort of thing for the fleet. Just before the war started, we came back here to Leon Solent, took the floats off, put wheels on, and off we went to the Orkneys. And I was in the Orkneys when war was declared.
What was it like flying the Swordfish?
Very nice, very nice. Open cockpit, and you didn't go, you sort of bogged along about 2,000 feet. You could get up to 10, but very seldom we did. And yes, I quite enjoyed it. I was up in the Orkneys till December 39. And the RAF lent us 3 Gladiators for fighter protection. So that's all we had in the Orkneys then, was 3 Gladiators to protect the north of Scotland.
How did you react when you heard that we were at war with Germany?
Well, we were expecting it, actually, because it was rather funny. I'd arranged to get married in the August before war started, and I kept getting, my wife lived in Essex and Saffron Walden, and instead of getting nearer, I was getting further away. I was getting up to Donnybristol in Fife, then Invergordon, as I said, then see the Orkneys. And I requested leave to get married, and requested to see him, the captain, and he thought it was a good idea, but my squadron commander said, no, he can't be spared, sir. As you know, any minute we'll be at war with a crafty Hun. So I think the servicemen there, we knew it was coming along, I think. And we're at Hatston when Chamberlain gave that speech. Well, look, we're now at war with Germany.
How confident did you feel that Britain could handle Germany in the war when war was declared?
Oh, we have the opinion it was no problem. How wrong we were. Yeah, I think there was so much propaganda. I mean, you're a much younger fellow than me. But then, you know, it was the stories going around. The Germans had cardboard tanks, and the aeroplanes were much inferior to what we had. And I think that they'd kidded us, you know, that was it. But as we found out later, it was a totally different problem. No, I think that we thought, you know, it's it, you know, and it'll be over in about 3 months. I think this was the same theory, I gather, in the 1418 war, you know, what my father told me. And looking back, you know, we didn't think there was going to be much of a problem. But as it was, it went on and on and on.
You said that your wife came from Essex. Do you come from Essex?
Yes, Ipswich, actually. Suffolk.
From Suffolk.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, Can we go on to the Norwegian campaign?
Yeah.
And can you tell me in detail, right from the beginning, what you remember of your own participation in that?
Yeah, well, I think I'll carry on. So I came here for the seaplane conversion course. We were at Hatston. And then I was sent down here to Lee to do a walrus refresher course, which I did here, a couple of trips. And then I was sent my draft ship, HMS Warspite. And I joined her in Greenock. And the funny thing, I was going out in the motorboat. There was an aircraft on the catapult. It wasn't the walrus, it was a swordfish on floats. So I joined the ship, and there was another pilot there, Lieutenant Barton. Two observers, Lieutenant Commander Brown and Lieutenant Aiken, two air gunners, Morris Pacey and McRae, and a corporal fitter who looked after the aeroplanes, and two airmen. And actually, when I joined, two air mechanics went along, so we were gradually taking over the maintenance from the RAF. That was in January 40. We then went up, we went to Scapa, and on our way to Norway in the end of March and April. And incidentally, the other pilot, Lieutenant Barton, left before we left Scapa. He went, he got fed up and wanted to join the RAF, and apparently the captain let him go. So I was the only pilot on board at Narvik. And I said we were... Well, I've written some more stuff down here, I think, which will interest you. Actually, we were briefed by the Admiral, Captain Victor Crutchley, who was the Captain of Wars by the time. He was a VC from the 1418 War. Commander Curry, who was a staff officer. The brief was to carry out a general reconnaissance for the fleet advancing up the Otlesfjord, particular reference to the presence of German warships inside the fjords, movement of German forces, and the position of shore batteries. Two, bomb any suitable targets. We were catapulted at 11:52 on Friday the 13th of April, 1940, in Swordfish, float plane L9767. The crew was myself, pilot, Lieutenant Commander Brown, observer. Leading Airman Pacey was the air gunner. You interested in the bomb load?
Yes, please.
Yeah. We were carrying two 250-pound high-explosive bombs, 200-pound anti-submarine bombs, and eight 40-pound anti-personnel bombs. The load of the Swordfish roughly on floats was about 1,000 pounds. You couldn't carry a torpedo with floats because there wasn't sufficient... the floats weighed too much. Actually, then we actually carried on up the fjord, reporting the position of the German destroyers, and this was done by Pacey, the air gunner, because it was all WT, no RT at all in those days. So Commander Brown would write the stuff down, give it to Morris, and he would tap it out and back to the ship. And I don't know if... Mr. Smith has told you the destroyers weren't even on the same frequency. They weren't receiving all these reports. And actually he was shot down, and I think he was picked up by the Hero. He probably,
yes.
Yeah. And he got on board there and said, "Oh, why aren't you listening to this aircraft that's up there?" And I think he persuaded the chief telegraphist, sorry, it was aboard, and they actually switched over the frequency and were receiving the message. But that was something we didn't realise at the time. Anyway, we were reporting all back to the Warspite what was going on. Eventually, as we got to nearly up to the top of the fjord, all of a sudden I saw a U-boat on the surface. And I shouted out, and left, you know, oh, well, I mustn't say what I said. I said, there's a U-boat on the up there. Where? He said, you know. And he said, what are you going to do? I said, well, let's bomb the button, but whatnot.
Which direction was the U-boat in relation to you?
She was practically ahead up the fjord. I think, if I remember, yeah. Yes, I think we were just going to turn and come back. And I sort of looked up there, and there I saw this up the top of this difficult to pronounce that. That's the name of the fjord. The town, that was, sorry. Yeah.
Yes, it's BJREVKVIK.
Yeah,
however they pronounce it.
Yeah, that was the place. I then selected the two anti-submarine bombs, and actually we were about 1,000 feet, so you couldn't do much of a dive bomb, but I put the aircraft into a bit of a dive. Pardon me. Dropped the two bombs, and fortunately one of them hit above the conning tower. And actually I turned away, and the next thing I saw was the stern sticking out the water. Actually, she did open fire on us, and I think she hit us with a shell from a 37mm gun, but we're not sure. She hit us in the tail, didn't do a lot of damage, managed to carry on flying. We then carried on reconnaissance down the fjord, and eventually at 4 o'clock the war spider stopped off the town of Narvik. We landed alongside and were hoisted back in. I expect you've got most of the... There was 8 German destroyers were sunk during this action. I was awarded the Distinguished Service Medal. The observer was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross. The poor old air gunner got mentioned in dispatches. Only one actual point of interest. Admiral Whitworth was the flag officer in charge, and in his report he said if ever a shipborne aircraft has been used to such good purpose. Oh, I doubt, wrote Admiral Whitworth in his report, if ever a shipborne aircraft had been used to such good purpose. So that was rather pleasing from our point of view. There we are.
How exciting was it for you in this attack on the U-boat?
Well, it happens fairly fast, you know. You, all of a sudden I said, God, blimey, there it is. And, you can't muck about because obviously it was fairly, he'd see you and you'd seen him, and as we were diving he was firing at us, and we pulled away, and there it was, you know.
Were you scared in an action like that?
I don't think so, no. No, I mean, I'm not being rough. I don't, you weren't, no, I think your pre-war training, I think, as a pilot, that was your job, and now a lot of people say, no, I don't think so at the time. I mean, I don't think we realised, how serious it was. I don't think it got through to us, I don't know. The ship's company at Wasp back then, they were, I should say, nearly everybody was pre-war trained. There were no hostility only, not that I've got anything against hostility. They were all pre-war trained, from the captain down to the boy seaman on board. And we were all sort of, by then everybody been in the war before, or in the Navy before the war. And I think you were trained for, that was the job you were sort of trained for, wasn't it?
Did you feel that your training and preparation for all this was adequate or inadequate?
Oh, adequate, I think, yeah, yes. Because I think the great thing about, I think my course, there was, as I said, 16 of us qualified, and there were still 12 alive after the war. And in most pilots' courses during the war, you were lucky to find somebody else who was still alive. I think the training was so lax pre-war. You see, we used to go down Monday morning. You would split into two parts. Half of you would fly; the others would go ground instruction. Afternoon was the same. Wednesday afternoon it was sports, and you didn't work on a Saturday. You went down the hangar and cleaned the aircraft, and Sunday was a day of rest. And it. It wasn't until the war came on that the sort of training intensified, when you were allowed to go out every evening if you wanted to. We started at Lucas in Fife. We then moved out to Netheravon in Hampshire. And we were fully qualified when the war started. The training was no rush, and so you made sure that you were fully trained pilot.
Did you find anything out subsequently about the submarine that you attacked?
Yeah, I can give you the full details if you want.
Yes.
Actually, here we are. She was the U-64. She was a Type 1XB, and she was 1,051 tons on the surface, 1,178 submerged. The captain was Schlitz. I'll spell this for you: S-C-H-U-L-X. She was brand new, and her trials had been curtailed to take part in the Norwegian operation. Complement was 68 personnel. He was 251 feet long, 22 feet beam, 15 feet draft. She's a two-shaft diesel oblique electrics. The diesels gave 4,400 horsepower, and your submerged was 1,000 horsepower. Speed on the surface 18 knots, submerged 7 knots. Torpedoes, she carried 22, had 4 bow tubes, 2 stern tubes. Guns, she had one 10.5 centimetre, one 37 millimetre, and one 20 millimetre. 68 men survived from this operation. 36, sorry, I've got my glasses on. Yes, complement was 48, 36 survived. So there was 12 actually perished, unfortunately. Incidentally, U-64 was the first German submarine to be sunk from the air in World War II.
Now, after you got back from this operation, what did you do next?
Well, we Commander Brown and myself reported to the bridge, and we were debriefed by Commander Curry, the staff officer, what had happened. And that was it. And then we went down and had a cup of tea.
Did you have any other duties at Norway?
No.
You then left Norwegian waters, did you?
That's right, yes. We left left Norwegian waters, came, then we went back to Greenock in Scotland. We were given a week's leave, and then off we went to the Mediterranean. And then we picked up flagship in the Mediterranean, which was Admiral A.B. Cunningham. And then we were based in Alexandria, in Egypt.
Did you see any action in the Mediterranean?
Yes, quite a bit.
Can you tell me about the details of it?
The main one, I think, was we did some bombardment along the North African coast at Calabria and Bardia and various places. Oh, incidentally, another pilot joined us, a Lieutenant Med, so we were then up to full complement. Up to then, as I said, I was the only pilot on board. By then, Lieutenant Commander Brown had been promoted commander, and actually, I think it was in the June 41, I think it was the cruiser Sydney, Australian cruiser, at sight of the Italian cruiser, and she got away, and they catapulted the aircraft off to go and search for this cruiser. Unfortunately, they went over to Brooke and they were shot down. So I'm back on my own again. And then Lieutenant Commander Bolt joined us, the replacement of Lieutenant Commander Brown, and our main thing was the Battle of Cape Matapan.
Can you tell me in detail what you remember about your own part in that?
Let me see. Yes, we were. There was the whole thing was that the admiral didn't quite know what was going on with the Italians. We knew there was the Italian battleship out, and a number of cruisers and quite a few destroyers. But I think it's all in a book about Matapan, which is called the Battle of Cape Matapan. Anyway, we catapulted off. I think we had various bombs on board again, and searched around the Mediterranean, and nobody found this Italian fleet. So back we came on board, back to the ship, and actually, incidentally, normally the ship does a crescent in the water, and you land alongside and come up, and you're hoisted in. The air gunner gets out on top of the main plane and does the sling, and under the crane you come. But actually, the war spike wouldn't stop for us. so they were chasing after this Italian battleship. So we landed in ahead of the fleet. The battleship came up alongside and fortunately sort of picked us up backwards. Anyway, we got back inboard and refilled, and I think there was no air rations then. We had a cup of tea, and Brown's Bolt said, "Look, well, off we go again." And by then it was fairly late in the afternoon, I think. So actually, funnily enough, we put on four flame floats under one of the wings on a bomb dropping thing, so if we had to land in the sea at night, we could drop these things down and would give us we never tried this, but anyway, it was an idea, you know. And off we went again, and fortunately we found contact with the Italian battle fleet, and we made the annual report back to the war spite, various number of battleships and cruisers and just the whole outfit of the fleet. And then, by then, along came a couple of the squadron of albacores, I think from the Lustrous or the Formidable, and they did a torpedo attack. Actually, they hit one of the cruisers, which slowed the cruiser up, but I don't think they damaged the battleship. And rather interesting, our annual report, I read a book by the Italian admiral after the war, and we were only one knot out in our estimation of speed. We said he was doing 17 knots, and he said he was doing 16. So that was quite a thing to read this. Obviously, the course was easy enough because you could plot that. But estimating a ship's speed from about 6,000 feet is difficult. But it was rather nice to read this. He was listening out to all our reports, funny enough. And the other thing I think was very interesting, same air gunner again, old Morris Basie. Of course, the ships don't transmit as WT silence, but he was transmitting all this off. Malta WT were receiving it, Alex WT received, and so were the Admiralty in London. So the Admiralty knew what was going on at the same time as the, which I think you think radio in those days, but obviously it was WT, and we were fairly high up, and it was getting right round the world.
What did the Italian fleet look like?
Very impressive, because the battleship was bigger than the Warspite and faster than the Warspite. She was sort of, I would say, on par looking at it, sort of like the Hood was. And they're I mean, you easily pick them out because they're entirely different design from British cruisers. I think same as American cruisers. You know, the silhouettes are different. They're fairly easy to pick out, even from 10 or 15 miles away. But it was quite an impressive layout, the formation of the fleet, the battleships, cruisers and the destroyers all on the outside. And then, anyway, along came, I say, the torpedo bomber aircraft from Lustrous and Formid, and by then we were getting, no,